The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hello, can I ask everyone to start taking your seats so we can get started?
On some level?
On a level, but very problematic.
There are rumors of snow again this afternoon, so we're hoping to get this conference wrapped up and have a reception a little earlier than planned so that we've had the full experience of the day, but everyone can get home before it actually does start snowing again. So, only half an inch. Rumors abated. Okay, so okay, we'd like to get started now with the second panel, the first panel of the afternoon. The focus of this panel is state building and the role of customary law in the process of state building, and particularly focusing on state building in transitional and post-conflict societies, although not only that context. We're very lucky to have Megan Stewart serving as our moderator. Megan Stewart is an attorney and a senior peace fellow with the Public International Law and Policy Group, PILPG. Ms. Stewart directs PILPG's Burma and Zimbabwe programs and co-directs the Water Diplomacy Project. Previously, Ms. Stewart served as the chief of party of PILPG's Sri Lanka program in Colombo, where she provided legal assistance on peace negotiations between the government of Sri Lanka and the LTTE. In 2005 and 2006, Ms. Stewart served as the advisor and primary drafter to the post-Dayton constitutional reform process in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So obviously, Ms. Stewart is in a very interesting position to moderate this panel on state-building processes. We also have with us today Professor Francis Sikandi, who's a lecturer in law at Columbia University School of Law, where he teaches African law and development. Professor Sikandi is from Uganda, and he previously served as a judge on the High Court and the Supreme Court of Uganda. During his time on those two courts, he authored a number of landmark decisions on various areas of customary law. And subsequent to his work on those two courts, he worked in the United Nations Office of Legal Affairs as general counsel for the African Bank. And also, he's currently serving as the judge on the World Bank Administrative Tribunal in addition to his teaching and consulting responsibilities. We also have with us Carolyn Sage, who is with the World Bank. She's a justice reform specialist and in the legal vice presidency. She heads up the program called Justice for the Poor, which focuses on legal empowerment and mainstreaming justice in conflict management. Her research interests are focused on regulatory and justice reforms in fragile and conflict-affected environments, particularly issues of legal pluralism, customary institutions, and the role of law in the process of social change. And finally, last but definitely not least, we have Professor Christine Zuni Cruz with us from University of New Mexico Law School. Professor Zuni Cruz teaches at the University of New Mexico, and in 1993 she established the Southwest Indian Law Clinic. She's also a tribal judge as an associate justice on the Isleta Appellate Court, and previously she was a tribal court judge on the Pueblo of Laguna and the Pueblo of Dallas. So we have a very distinguished panel, and please join me in welcoming them.
Good afternoon, everyone. Megan, thank you very much for the introduction. I wanted to thank the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law Student Advisory Board, the Human Rights Brief, and the International Human Rights Law Clinic for putting together this event today. I think this is a very important and timely issue for us to talk about. I also wanted to thank our panelists for braving the snow and joining us today, even with the threat of new snow. And as a WCL alum and a former member of both the Student Advisory Board and the Human Rights Brief, I'm very excited to be back here at WCL, taking part in a panel that I think is discussing one of the key challenges to new and old legal systems. Now, states around the world struggle with how to incorporate customary legal traditions into formalized systems of law. In my work, where I advise foreign governments on peace negotiations and post-conflict constitutions, I regularly work with leaders who are addressing the challenges of establishing national legal systems that recognize and integrate diverse legal traditions. From the perspective of a central government, harmonizing diverse traditions can be very challenging. And I wanted to provide you guys with a couple of examples of work that my colleagues and I are doing around the world, clients that we're advising, to give you some examples of the types of challenges that different governments are facing. In Burma, pro-democracy leaders are working on planning for a future federal democratic state that recognizes the unique traditions of dozens of ethnic nationalities, most of whom speak different languages and follow different traditional governance structures. Pro-democracy leaders are struggling to draft a constitution that recognizes the diverse traditions of the ethnic nationalities while also establishing a functioning central government. It's a very, very difficult balance. In Nepal, the Constituent Assembly is tackling the drafting of a new constitution that establishes a federal system of government. Nepal formerly had a constitutional monarchy with a centralized government. One of the key purposes of the federal system in Nepal is to decentralize authority in order to recognize local traditions and provide political authority to local groups. Decentralizing authority will be incredibly difficult, however, because most of the regions don't even have the basic infrastructure, meaning like roads and buildings, much less trained officials to house and run a government. It will therefore take many years for Nepal to implement a federal system that provides space for local governance and recognizes local traditions. In Somaliland, which is an autonomous region in Somalia, the government is working on drafting a constitution that incorporates three different legal traditions. So that's Sharia law, common law, and clan law. And they're trying to incorporate those three traditions into one legal system that meets international legal standards. It's a big challenge. Finally, in Uganda, where my colleagues are working, and I had the opportunity to travel last month, leaders are working to incorporate traditional justice mechanisms into the domestic war crime structure, which is being established to try members of the Lord's Resistance Army. The government must balance the requirements of international criminal law with the concerns of populations most affected by decades-long conflicts. And I'm hoping that Professor Sikandi might speak a little bit to Uganda in his talk. As these examples demonstrate, the challenges associated with incorporating customary and traditional law into national legal systems are both broad and complex. For today's panel, we're going to focus primarily on the incorporation of customary law into systems of justice. I'd like to invite each of our panelists to speak for about 15 minutes, give or take, on what they see as the greatest challenges associated with incorporating customary legal traditions, as well as the best practices and lessons learned from their experiences. In particular, I'd like to ask our panelists to speak to the specific challenges faced by developing states, and I'll provide a few questions. How those building a judicial system can establish court systems that accommodate legal pluralism, whether states have been more successful at incorporating customary law when they establish one legal system that applies or accommodates different bodies of law, or several separate but overlapping and interacting legal systems that each apply a different system of law. If states establish separate systems, how do the different bodies of law or different justice systems interact? What are the upsides and downsides of one form or another, in particular with regard to the protection of human rights? And finally, how can international law help or hinder the incorporation of customary law into domestic legal structures? I hope that our panelists will be able to draw upon their experiences to help us begin to answer some of their questions. On that note, I'd like to turn to our first panelist, Professor Sikandi. Thank you for joining us, and I turn the podium over to you.
Do I get to see it here? You know, I can use it. this one. Okay. I'm sorry. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me. The invitation took me by surprise, but in between my traveling, I was able to put together something that I hope will respond to the challenge that has been thrown at us. I think I'll stick to the script of what I prepared for you. And if at the end I can speak to the other issues that have been raised by the moderator, I would be glad to. But I thought I would might give you some kind of context of the application, the status and application of customer law in Africa. Before I do that, I just want to clarify a few things. One, there is always a very big danger in generalizing when talking about Africa, and especially talking about customer law. And this is demonstrated by what has been described as Professor Mamdani's perception of the customary project in Africa, with which I totally disagree. It's been thrown at me by students, his former students, many times, who have challenged me saying that customary law is actually an imposition of the colonial powers. I get a little bit offended because if you describe customary law as an imposition of the colonialists, you are almost saying that the Africans lived as savages without any legal norms to govern their lives. Because when we talk about customary law, we're talking about those norms that the community over time accepted as binding their lives and they live by it. If that is the definition, then obviously we have to be able to separate the chaff from the real. If there has been a distortion in the course of the colonial administration through institutions that were compromised and laws that were probably adjusted because of the intervention of the supervisors of courts, we can forget those. And when we talk about customary law today, as administered by the various countries that are now independent, we're talking about those rules that communities do accept as binding on them. They are unwritten. That's why they call it customary laws. So, having put that aside, I'll go to my script. African states are mostly a collection of nations and nationalities. This use of the word nations and nationalities is to be found in the Ethiopian constitution, and I find it very interesting. Because instead of calling them tribes and clans and families, these various communities before the balkanization of Africa into what they call states today governed themselves as separate nations with different administrations. And ranging from a more sophisticated, probably the most sophisticated administrative structure like Buganda, and probably the Ashanti in Ghana, to probably the more rudimentary clan-based administrations like you find in Somalia. So it is very difficult to generalize, but there was organized administrative structures before those various nations and nationalities were balkanized by the colonial powers. The problem today we face is that we have quote-unquote states that are actually not nations. because they are composed of people who still adhere to their own, what they call, tribal affiliations, for lack of a better word. The independence that gave rise to the modern state was forced on the colonial powers following the end of the Second World War, either by movements led by those who had seen a better life when they were conscripted to fight in Europe and other places, or by political elites that had occasion to read calls for self-governance, and also led also by countries like the United States that looked at colonialism as an offensive form of administration, and the United Nations, of course, which assisted in ushering in independence. So in a hurry, institutions such as national assemblies were put together by the colonials to meet local demands, and elections were organized to choose among competing political agitators. Traditional institutions and customary laws were swept aside in the process, largely because in the course of agitation for independence, the political elites looked at the chiefs and the traditional institutions as compromised during the colonial period because they had been co-opted in the colonial enterprise. The legal systems that had been imposed originally to administer laws for the foreign merchants and settlers were very quickly made universally applicable to everybody in the country, to the exclusion sometimes of the existing customary laws. Upon the attainment of independence, political leaders were not uniform in how to tackle customary law. In countries like Tanzania, an attempt was made to codify customary law. And to this day, you have a codified system of customary law in Tanzania, which is administered in a unified legal system. In Kenya, the government decided to have a restatement of customary law, which was produced by Eugene Cotran of the Oriental and African Studies. And this restatement is an inspiration used by the courts when needed to discover what the rules should be applied. In the Francophone African states, the policy from the beginning was to suppress customary law and replace it by the code, Napoleonic. In its ambition to do that, the African law only continued to exist underneath, informally, being applied outside the formal system. In the southern African states, you find that Roman Dutch law was administered more or less like the common law and was side by side administered with the English common law in some places as well as with the customary law. But as has been very well described in South Africa, the attempts in South Africa was to produce a codified system of customary law in the black administration of black law, which was enacted in 1927. The dual system of courts and laws existed during the colonial times, but I think many of the African countries have integrated the courts into a unified system, and probably That's what the majority of the people in South Africa would like to see, instead of continuing with the dual system of courts, because the experience of many of the populations was that the local courts presided over by the chiefs did not meet the aspirations of the people, because many of the chiefs had been sort of contaminated by the colonial attempts at suppression of the population. And there was very little faith in the chiefs presiding over courts. And I think in the countries which have adopted a unified system of courts, what is missing essentially is that the lawyers who are manning these courts have almost to a number received very little training in the customary law, so that it is so much easier when faced with a case to look up Holsbury's laws or the English law reports and find an answer, rather than try to intelligently discover what the customary law might be on the issue. One case that has become very famous is the case of Otieno, burial case in Kenya, where the lawyer, actually, Otieno, died without writing a will. Having written many wills for everybody, he forgot to write a will for himself. And his widow, who happened to be of a different tribe, of the Kikuyu tribe, he came from Western Kenya, wanted to bury him in her home community in Nairobi. But his parents and relatives wanted, as is the custom, to bury him alongside his ancestors. And that case was essentially a lost opportunity, because the lawyer who was hired by Mrs. Otieno, a good friend of mine, Mr. Kaminwa, decided to argue the case based on English legal precedents and totally forgot what we had actually been taught at law school, because we were together in the law school, that there are other ways of examining rules that apply, which could include customary law. And Mr. Quach, who argued the case for the relatives of Mr. Tieno, also a good friend of mine, was much more astute in bringing into evidence the relatives who testified as to the customs of the Luo. And another criticism has been that, in fact, at the University of Nairobi, there had been more than enough research on the issue of customary burials, which could have been brought into court. So one of the disadvantages we have with the integrated court system is almost like putting, what do you say, new wine or old wine? What's the expression in English? You put new wine in old pots? No, trying to administer, well, it's an English expression, trying to administer customary law in a structure which is actually alien to customary law. The judicial system that we inherited, at least in the common law countries, structured along the English system of courts, and the requires that evidence be produced to the judge for decision. The judge cannot decide on anything other than the evidence that has been produced in the court. And that is a handicap, in the sense that if one of, and again you have the two-party system whereby each side has produced evidence. If one party has not produced the evidence necessary for decision, then the judge is handicapped in terms of arriving at a decision, because he has only evidence from one side. And I think that's one reform that could be adopted side by side to the integration of the courts, and probably revise as well the rules of evidence, which unfortunately we still continue to use the English rules of evidence in the courts, and also representation, probably do like the civil law system, whereby the judge is given very more broad scope of questioning the parties and even bringing evidence into the court rather than using the common law system. However, the imported law is applied only insofar as the local circumstances permit, according to the order in council that introduced the imported law, but also now as most of the judicature acts which continue to apply the customary law do state. It is that provision that has allowed the application of customary law, again meaning that the first legal rule you look at is the common law, the statutes of general application, and equity before you go on to apply the common law, I mean the customary law. That puts a restriction on the leeway the judge has in applying customary law. And when you apply customary law, unfortunately, it is only to the extent that it is not repugnant to justice and good conscience. And as most of the constitutions now state, it is consistent with the provisions of the Constitution and other written law. Those are tremendous restrictions on the level of the amount of customary law that can be applied. The period of independence from about 1960, Ghana got independence much earlier, but round about 1960, most of the countries began getting independence, up to the round about the middle of 1966, when most of the countries experienced coup d'etats, was riddled by political elites experimenting with the discarding of the old ways. The politicians tried to convince the populace that we have to catch up on development and we don't have time. We're in a hurry. Human rights and traditions are in our way. We have to adopt certain different systems. African socialism, we have to adopt different systems like one-party states, because in the olden days you had one chief and one king. You didn't have political pluralism. However, these experiments proved very unsuccessful because they did not have any basis, basically, in custom, because the replacement of a president of a king or a chief by a president who began being elected and then failed to continue the elections, declared himself a life president, tended to imitate the king, but not providing the services or the respect that the kings enjoyed in the traditional old days. So the cultural wars that ensued after independence were interrupted by a period of dictatorship led by the military, bringing us to the 90s, when there has been a kind of revival, and the revival of constitutionalism, which has also been assisted by donor community and the human rights movement, have brought to Africa and many African states new constitutions with a lot of provisions which are intended to capture the international standards that everybody adhered to. The question I think one asks is, in adopting these constitutions, was there a will to abide by these provisions? Were they aware of what the provisions mean? And was there actually a will to adhere to them? A question was posed to Njuma, former president of Namibia. I think some human rights activists went to ask him why his government is persecuting homosexuals. And doesn't he know that the Constitution contains provisions about equal rights? And are you violating the equal rights of these individuals? And Zuma said, young lady or young boy, whatever it was, don't teach me what my Constitution says. That was his reaction. So I think basically there are two, I think, big problems that we are faced today. One, many African states are signatories to CEDAW. They're signatories to the International Covenants on Human Rights. And they have adopted the Banjul Charter on people's rights, the African Charter on Human Rights. And now we heard this morning they have come up with various protocols for the protection of the children and the rights of women. Most of these instruments are compromises. And the question is whether in adopting them, the countries in Africa particularly, which is what I'm familiar with, actually intended to apply them at the expense of what they knew would be a difficult task, resistance from their own people. And I think that the compromise was to include in all these instruments, almost to the letter, one catchword which has now caused the difficulty in terms of judicial application, and that is the right to culture. The right to culture is all-embracing and was conceived as being sufficient to protect our customary law and the various customs. I think a lot of the courts now are struggling with reconciling this. In the case of Doe, I don't know, some of you may have heard about the case of Doe in Botswana, where there was a citizenship issue. Doe was a Botswana citizen, married to a U.S. citizen. They had a child out of wedlock that, of course, under English law, if born out of wedlock, you have the citizenship of your mother, and they had two other children born in wedlock, and under English law also, then would be acquiring the citizenship of the father. So because Doe, I think Mrs. Doe was giving the government some headache sometimes, they would make sure they pay her back. Every time she wanted to travel abroad, she had to have a visa for her two children and her husband. But the other Botswana kid, of course, who was a Botswanian, would go with no problem. And she felt there was discrimination between her own kids. She brought the case to court. But Botswana had a court of appeal that was composed of international judges, not Botswana judges, who decided to apply the international covenants and African Charter of People's Rights and Duties. And said that there was, the law was unconstitutional. The case has been cited, I think quite wrongly, as a conflict between customary law and international covenants, and I think very mistakenly, because the provision on citizenship in the Botswana Constitution was actually a mirror image of old English law as it applied, and was actually inherited at the times of independence. And the conflicts of laws, as I studied them, at least in England, until recently when they may have been amended, did bear out the principle that if you bear a child out of wedlock, the child assumes the nationality of the mother. That's not customary law. It's English law. So I don't think that the case has been a good example of the conflict between customary law and international covenants. Now, a fresh approach. I have I have pondered very seriously what we can actually do to see whether customary law can be used as actually a force for state building. I think we have to view customary law not so much as individual rules or individual norms, but to look at the customary law as a legal system. And if you look at it as a legal system, then you would probably be able to, when writing constitutions, visualize its application in whole. One country that seems to have been able to do this is Somaliland. In the ashes of the civil war that led to the overthrow of Siad Barre and the clan wars that ensued and enveloped Mogadishu, Somaliland broke away, led by the elders in Somaliland. They reconstituted an Indaba, using a Southern African expression, but they call it a Guti in Somaliland, and agreed to set up an administrative structure based on their old tradition. They have conceded that the leaders must be elected, but these leaders must be answerable to the elders. And the elders have reconstituted themselves into a formal body that puts checks and balances on the activities of these political elites that are elected as leaders. And this is at least one good example where you have customary institutions remodeled to fit modern requirements that actually leaders be elected, but at the same time retaining some of the good aspects of using elders as a bulwark against abuse. One of the biggest problems we are having in Africa today and recurring is that once elected, the politicians don't look at themselves as servants of the people, but they look at themselves as running the country to enrich themselves, almost to the number. It is a source of wealth and power. They grab land, they marry more wives, and acquire more wealth. And that is, I think, something that has to be rooted out through reconstituting the state. The Constitution must provide more than just mention of culture or custom. It must define and allocate customary institutions meaningful, roles in state governance power structures. Inherited institutions such as Parliament, Cabinet, and Presidency need to be reconstituted in such a way as to be relevant and play a meaningful role for the ordinary people. The Presidency, Cabinet, have turned into seats of power and sources of riches instead of centers of providing services to the people. Once elected, none of the elected elites pay attention to the needs of their constituencies. And I gave you already the example of the Guti. In Ethiopia, I think the other aspect I'd like to cover before I cede my seat is the question of judicial review. I think we are seeing judicial review go amok. I call it judicial review going amok in South Africa, where the Constitutional Court has, in a case quoted by my colleague in Bay, arrogated itself, I think, more powers than the court should actually possess. One, they have probably rightly declared the aspects of the Bantu administration of Bantu law legislation to be unconstitutional. I have no problem with that. Two, have inquired into the application of customary law, which I have no problem with, but gone on to actually declare the customary law without any substitution or review or idea on how it should be applied and abolished it without leaving a vacuum to be filled by an apartheid-made succession law in its place. And I think that is, in my view, not the way to apply judicial review. The Constitution, from a jurisprudential point of view, is not an ordinary norm. The Constitution is a political instrument. If you go by Kelsen, the Constitution as a grand norm is actually a political act. So being a political act, I think to subject this Constitution to interpretation by courts with respect to what you have in this country, which works, I'm talking about my countries in Africa, by courts who are steeped in law and legal theory, but with no political accountability, is, in my view, not doing justice to the constitutional instrument that has been negotiated as a compact, social compact for the people. The example I found that was very attractive is, again, Ethiopia, where they have created a constitutional court with which is presided over by the Chief Justice, but with membership from a cross-section of the community, including some lawyers, but also including other people, laymen and elders. And this comes up with a judgment, not really a judgment in the real sense, but comes up with a recommendation to the Senate, which adopts it. So in other words, there is a legislative force in a decision that comes out interpreting the Constitution and applies like any other legal instrument. So there cannot be a question of this judgment may be undermined by congressional acts because the judgment goes against political understanding of what is right and wrong. I mean, in other words, where you find a judgment of this highest court having to be overturned by congressional enactment would not occur in this particular case because the congressional or the assembly would have had an opportunity to look at and endorse that particular judgment. Now, that I think would probably correct some of the things that are going wrong. In Uganda, my own country, a number of things have happened at the same time with the Constitutional Court, where at the time of independence, Uganda took the view, according to the then Attorney General, that customary law will wither away, given a chance and time. So we look into customary law and see those things that are needed, and we legislate. So three things were found. They found that the adultery and elopement are two things that are so universally practiced that can be put into legislation and they were incorporated in the penal code. But they were incorporated with their own appendages because under customary law, a woman is punished more than the man if he's caught in adultery. So they did provide in the law that the woman would be punished more severely than the man. And the Court of Appeal most recently has declared this law to be unconstitutional because it violates the Equal Protection Clause. Now, elopement has not been touched upon. Probably they have not found out yet because maybe somebody has not complained yet. But this adultery law, when the Constitutional Court struck it down, was like a day before Christmas, and the newspaper's headlines were, "May everyone now go and celebrate in peace." Headlines. You can, in other words, commit adultery as you please. The judiciary has its own limitations because you cannot just strike with no replacement. You don't just decide, you know, I strike it down, it's unconstitutional, and there's absolutely no replacement. And this is something that maybe the court should have looked at it and said there is some inequality here, let it be corrected, but not say it is unconstitutional, it is put aside. And as the paper said, everybody went on celebration. The legislative option, I think, in terms of what to do with the customer law, of course, there has been attempts in some countries to replace customer law with legislation, and I think that is probably not right. I agree with my colleague from South Africa that we have to see whether customer law can be built from the ground up, and I think the only way is to empower the courts. But empowering the courts, which they already do in some of these countries, is not sufficient unless these courts are well equipped in applying the customer law. Many of our law schools, unfortunately, don't even have a course on customer law. And a lot of judges that administer these courts have absolutely no idea and have no source to turn to find what the rules in customer law are. Essentially, under the Evidence Act, you're supposed to call elders to testify as to what is the custom and then be able to decide. One of the things I've done as a contribution to this lacuna is to establish a website, www.jurisafrica.org, where I'm posting any and sundry articles and papers that address African law, and I post them on this website, so that at least after 50 years, hopefully, there will be a source on various aspects of law in this field. Now, transitional justice is my passion. I have done a lot of work in Rwanda on the Gacaca jurisdictions. I was surprised by one of my students about 4 years ago who wrote about the traditional Ubuti, whatever they call them, in the north of Uganda. She never told me she was going to write about my own country, but in the final paper, I allow my students to write research papers, which gives them the opportunity to do research and produce works that probably could fill this void. And she wrote about the various customary practices that are being explored in the north to try to deal with the problem of integrating the fighters from the Lord Resistance Army. Many of the times I didn't know because it's not my language, but I am very familiar with the Gacaca. I was in Rwanda when the Gacaca jurisdictions law was adopted. I assisted in trying to bring it to a stage where it addresses some of the problems that I found in the law to make it fair to the accused. And also in the initial, initial trials, I assisted with that. But the thing is that the Gacaca is a very good experiment. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa is also one good way of going about it. One of the dilemmas that I think faces anybody in this field is to try to understand what we mean by justice. And I think this is where everybody's gotten lost. I think we look at justice the way we read in the books, the way we look at it from the West, the way we look at it from, I do not know, international instruments. Justice is not calculated only in trials and punishment. I don't think that you only achieve justice by having a Western-based trial and conviction. I think that one has to, in at least transitional societies where you have like a genocide in or a situation like Uganda went through, the atrocities of Amin, and this has been going on in various countries. The question one has to ask oneself is, how do we allow the society to move on? How can the people who have suffered be able to reconcile themselves with those who have committed the atrocities and move on to live together. I think this is more a priority than having trials and having convictions and punishment, because punishment only continues the agony. I mean, like in Cambodia now, they are resurrecting the Pol Pot atrocities by having trials. In Rwanda, the trials are just continuing the genocide trauma, while the Interahamwe are regrouping in the Congo for another day to achieve justice according to themselves. So I think one has to rethink. Even the ICC, one of the things that I was critical about was when the peace talks were taking place in the north, the ICC should have stepped aside and agreed to vacate the indictments against Kone. This insistence that we continue and try and so on, over the last 5 years, under the amnesty law in Uganda, more than 90% of the Lord Resistance Army fighters have been let go under the amnesty. So the 10% now are going to be put into trial. I do not know whether that is justice.
Thank you very much, Professor Sikandi. And I'm going to turn the podium over to... Did you all choose a different order? Carolyn Sage is going next. Thank you.
You have to excuse me if I yawn. My 20-month-old was up all night, so I'm just a little frazzled. I'm actually sort of going to twist this whole thing. I obviously come from a different perspective than many people in the room actually currently practicing as a development practitioner. I suppose that's what one would call it. And in an organization that projects out into the world that it actually knows how to do a lot of this stuff. It knows how to do state building, and it knows how to deal with justice reform. And now it might know how to start incorporating customary law into these processes as well. That would be really great. And so, and I think instead of trying to say, well, how do we, instead of starting with a question of how do we incorporate customary law into state building, I just wanted to reflect a little bit on, I think to some extent, what Professor Sikandi was indicating to us, where has this state building come from? And if you actually understand the history of the state building agenda, then I think even the question starts to be possibly moot, but that's, we'll see where we get to in the end. So as Professor Sikandi was indicated, state building comes very much out of a post-colonial era, sort of 1930s, this sudden belief that we could, that through direct policy action we could actually implement changes in a very particular way. Obviously there's a whole history of that in colonialism, but now it was somehow done for the good of humanity, that we could actually move countries from a sort of stateless, disorganized, fragile, as they're now called, situation into a nice Weberian state that would suddenly work, that would have a flourishing private sector. The flourishing private sector would make revenues that would then support the core state. The core state could then provide services. And we had the answer to all problems, which was basically liberalism. And liberalism has been an incredibly powerful discourse that has permeated the entire development, community, and to some extent I think is an inherent value that most people in development have without even really questioning it. But liberalism comes with a whole series of very clear normative frameworks. And a liberal state is very much built on a rule of law state and an assumption about the role of law, the role of rights, who has the right to make decisions about these things, the balance of power. And we have... When we undertake development, that underlies all of our processes. And yet we sort of introduce these processes as if they're value-free, as if they're sort of technocratic, administrative processes that we're bringing into a country and that somehow they're going to either be sort of embraced by everybody, that if they're not embraced, we can push that it's a human right sort of vision. And I'm not... that sounds very kind of... negative, but I think it's not about saying whether a liberal We had a customary law conference very recently, and Professor Brian Tamanaha came, and he gave a speech. We had this whole debate that went on for about 3 or 4 days. I don't know if any of you were able to attend. And Professor Tamanaha at the end said, I just have a sort of question for all of you. Do you genuinely not believe in liberalism? Because if you do believe in liberalism, if you do believe in the liberal state, that comes with it a whole gamut of responsibilities about accepting what that means in terms of your own values and the values you're projecting into the world. And a state-building agenda in a development organization is inherently based on modernism and a structure of liberalism that organization, an organization such as the World Bank, has to some extent embodies. So anyway, so I think, what is state building? So if that's state building, then if that is sort of like the macro concept of what state building is, the kind of construction of a liberal state, then what's the role of law in that, law and regulation more generally? Because any discussion to me of customary law needs to be thought about in a context of law and regulation more generally. Well, to me, in a liberal state, the law is the fundamental framework of a liberal state. The rule of law system is the structure of a liberal state. But in most of the countries where I work, that structure doesn't exist at all. And in most of my colleagues' minds, when they're introducing state-building regimes, that structure doesn't exist at all either. Law is very... Law and structures of regulation in the development machinery and the development methods is often missing. And if it's not missing, it's sectorized. We talk about the justice sector. We can go in and we can build courts, we can train attorneys, we can build law schools, and we can have legal aid clinics, and somehow, therefore, we're going to create a rule of law system. A rule of law system is not the institutions that might administer some of the aspects of that system. The legislature, all of these systems are at the very core of state building. But not only that, those systems are very much socially embedded. They are the articulation of the norms and values of particular communities. And in a modern, most countries that consider themselves rule of law states, those norms are relatively compatible. Now, relative I don't believe in the death penalty, but I live in a country where the death penalty is implemented in many states. I've bought into the overall system because that is the structure within which I live, and to maintain some kind of peace and order, that is the system. When I buy my bus ticket, I buy into every moment of my day, I buy into the system of law that exists. And it fits with my norms and I understand it, and I know which aspects of it I don't agree with and I will push up against. So there's an assumption all the way through that system that there's an overarching framework and that there's a normative acceptance of it at the bottom. So that system, I think the concept that we can actually pick it up and move it and put it somewhere else is incredibly flawed. So we have a state building system, we have a rule of law system, we have a justice sector reform program, which is something, part of my world at the moment, in which there is this development vehicle that believes it can import and transplant systems into other countries for these countries' benefit. And then we have a sort of international system that's built on this, an international system that's built on states and sovereignty that is the way that we can deal with the disaster of post-colonial world. How are we going to deal with it? We're going to sort of order it. We're going to use aid to help these countries get up to become equal to us so we can all sort of work together. The problem is, well, one of the many problems is, but the main problem is, it hasn't worked. So even if we believed in it, the history of development is incredibly, is full of major failures. So even if you thought, well, this would be the ideal world, and this is one of the arguments I have often with my human rights colleagues, is even if you believe that female genital mutilation in Sierra Leone is bad, there were only 20 lawyers in Sierra Leone when the war finished. It's not a useful starting point to me. It may be somewhere you want to go to, but it's not a useful starting point. So these sorts of assumptions, these beliefs that you can create a state through some sort of transplantation, the history of social change, the history of development tells us it doesn't work. Okay, I will speed up. So if you are really going to think about, okay, we've got a justice sector reform program, it's not just customary law that's problematic. It is the whole kind of theory around what is law in development. As I said, it's kind of missing. There's a lack of theory about what a justice system does when we actually design justice sector reform programs. There's a lack of understanding of the type of development problem this is. As I say, we believe it's a technocratic problem rather than actually a social or political problem. And then there's also a very strong, you know, as I said, a strong proclivity to import best practices. So what do you do if you sort of, this is the tradition of justice sector reform without customary law. Since the 90s, as Professor Sakani said, there's been this revival about what do we do about customary law. One of the reasons, as I said, is because doing normal justice sector reform without looking and state building without looking at customary systems hasn't worked. There's a few kind of really serious concerns I have about this new trend, which is a big trend, believe me. There's been a big jump in the development communities out of formal state reform into informal justice systems at the moment. It kind of feels to me a bit like we don't know what to do with formal state jurisdictions, so we'll go and mess with informal systems. There's also this really big problem, which I think Hadair was trying to get at a little bit of, this assumption of equivalence. This idea that these are legal systems and they're the same and you can somehow put them into two categories. When, in fact, the sources of legitimacy might be very different. The sources of identity might be very different. I worked with Aboriginal communities for many years before I came to the States, and one of the key sources of legitimacy were the social networks that the elders had and the types of corresponding obligations they had through those social networks. Through a Western legal framework, that was suddenly called patronage and corruption. And yet we expected these elders to sit on boards in which they had public roles, which meant that they weren't allowed to fulfill their obligations. As soon as they stopped fulfilling their obligations, they no longer were deemed legitimate as elders, and so they no longer were allowed to sit on the boards. And there was this incredible cyclical process by which both their roles as board members and their roles as elders was undermined. And as one elder said to me at one point, if I had to choose between my law and your law, which do you think I would choose? It's a very, you know, his law meant death or fundamental loss of identity and fundamental loss of community. And that versus jail was actually a much bigger thing. So I think there's often an assumption of equivalence. There's also an assumption of difference. There's an assumption that, you know, that customary law abuses human rights. And I think if you look at any Western legal system, as I just said, to me the death penalty is a complete abrogation from the human rights responsibilities of this country. We look at most of the formal justice sectors, justice mechanisms that I work with in different countries are deemed corrupt, are deemed paternalistic, are deemed all sorts of things. But we perceive them as institutions we need to work with, we need to reform, we need to think about how they can be improved. When a customary legal system has something wrong with it, we perceive it to be ultimately damned, to be therefore something we need to cut off. And I think that this is this incredible sort of dichotomy of thinking around these two types of institutions. We also assume that we have this continued dichotomization, state, non-state, law, custom, culture, rights, universalist, relativist, form, function, west, the rest. I think that actually the way that we set it up is this, it continuously undermines a legitimate discussion about how societies are ordered, what types of mechanisms actually provide the types of functions people need in that society, and what we should really be doing in development. What is it that people need? What's the problem? And what institution can actually help them at that time in that process? Sorry, I'm running. Okay. So if it's all a mess, because I don't want to sound completely negative, what can we actually do in terms of thinking about it differently? And I think that's why I said it from the beginning. Instead of just starting with the question of can and how can customary law be incorporated into state building, I think there needs to be a rethink about the basis of state building itself. Now that's a much bigger agenda than our discussion here today, but I think we should not start with the assumption that that is something we want to actually incorporate a consideration of customary law into. I think that we need to have a much more in-depth understanding of the role of law and regulation in society more generally. I think that looking at regulatory pluralism as something that actually exists in all countries of the world, and yes, in some countries a sort of form of meta-rules has appeared that actually allows for dispute resolution and accountability across different groups and different normative frameworks, but that this is not something that just exists in fragile or conflict-affected areas. that we need to realize that the rule of law system or a legal system is a continuously evolving process, and so is a customary law system. And I think there's a very static way that we look at certain both legal systems in development. That the very nature of a modern legal system is that it's constantly evolving. The very nature of a common law system is that each judgment moves the law along. So why is it not possible for us to think of customary law in the same way? The other thing that a legal system does to me, which I think is incredibly important for development, is it contains contestation. It creates peaceful contestation. And ultimately, development is about the distribution of rights and responsibilities, whether people like it or not. It moves about power. And by actually development itself, therefore, can become a huge problem in places where you don't have strong systems to contain peaceful contestation. And so if you actually start pouring resources into places where there is no mechanism to contain the contests that are going to come out of those new resources, then I think to some extent we're often causing a lot of the problems that undermine states on the first instance, or actually that lead to sort of ongoing rent-seeking behaviour. So if you can think about law as one of the things that actually is part and parcel of any development project, that we need to think about what are the rules and regulations, what are the dispute resolution mechanisms, and what are the mechanisms by which people can hold people to account in this development process, immediately customary law or local level legal systems or whatever one wants to call it become completely relevant. They're relevant in road projects, they're relevant in land projects, they're relevant in any development project that comes down and messes with the relationships of rights and responsibilities in a community. And to me, that's a better starting point as a development practitioner. I'm not saying it's a better starting point as a constitutional lawyer or as a human rights lawyer, but as a development practitioner, the sectorisation of law is problematic to me, and actually we need to start thinking about, in every aspect of our development work, how are laws and regulations actually defining people's relationships and what types of mechanisms are there for people to resolve their dispute and contain contest. And in nearly all of the countries where I work, they are ultimately going to be customary systems in the first instance.
Thank you very much. And we will now move on to Professor Christine Zuni Cruz.
Good afternoon. I too want to thank the planners of this conference, the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law Student Advisory Board, the Human Rights Brief, and the International Human Rights Law Clinic. I think that the conference theme and subject is wonderful. This is the area that I teach in and write and spend a great deal of my time with. And so, of course, I think that the theme is brilliant. I want to begin by answering this question of how does customary law fit into or conflict with state building processes from two perspectives. I want to think about it both in terms of the state, the nation states in which indigenous peoples exist. Often I think it's illiberal societies, tribes existing within the liberal state. As well as thinking about it in terms of tribes who are tribes who have taken on some nature of state, and then how customary law conflicts with both structures, both the external structure and the political structure that tribes in the United States in particular have developed. But I think that it's very important to begin with defining and understanding and getting on the same page, or perhaps seeing that we're using terms that maybe fit imperfectly together. And so the term here is customary law, and I believe that many terms are used when one speaks about customary law generally. I've seen the terminology primitive law, traditional law, common law, as we heard from Professor Rossner this morning, which the Navajo Nation uses, indigenous law, and tribal law. Tribal law to me includes both this mixture of traditional oral law as well as this written mixed law, which might have some aspects of Western and some aspects of tribal law mixed in, or could be purely Western law. My preference is to utilize indigenous legal tradition or Thectonic legal tradition, as that term is referred to in a book by Glenn on the major legal traditions of the world. And he actually states or names seven major legal traditions in the world and names the indigenous legal tradition or the Thectonic legal tradition as one of the seven. And so in my writing about tribal law or traditional law, I often contrast the indigenous legal tradition to the common law tradition, which is the tradition that has developed in the United States. And I ground the indigenous legal tradition in indigenous knowledge. And indigenous knowledge has become more visible as there has arisen this struggle to resist impositions of intellectual property rights against indigenous knowledge. It's also arisen in order to protect indigenous knowledge at the international level. Indigenous knowledge itself has been defined by two Canadian scholars, and I draw much of my observations from their work, Batiste and Henderson. They define indigenous knowledge as being grounded in ecology, with strands of connectedness between indigenous peoples worldwide because ecologies have basic common principles. Then an observation that is made by Glenn is that today there is no peer Thectonic tradition that continues to exist. And this is because much of the colonization that has occurred has resulted in some blending of the indigenous legal tradition. But an important aspect of all of this is that indigenous knowledge and therefore indigenous legal tradition is diverse because indigenous peoples are diverse. And so when we think about what is Thectonic law and how this Thectonic law sits within an indigenous knowledge frame, I think it's important to explore what this means. Because indigenous knowledge stems from an ecological order, it is inextricably linked to the land. And as indigenous peoples today, we have land bases which may or may not reflect our traditional homelands and territories. But in any respect, these homelands, for the most part, do not contain all of the traditional lands and territories that that we see as our traditional lands. Despite this fact, we remain connected to the land through our law, through our knowledge of the land, and through our language. Our languages tie us and connect us to the land. They name the land that we see as our traditional territories. We're connected through our songs, through our stories, and through our ceremonies. All of these connect us to everything within those lands, including our ancestors. And so some of our lands overlap. So indigenous, more than one indigenous group can occupy lands. Some are shared lands, and there is some contestation between indigenous groups around, surrounding the land. But our traditional lands cover the vast areas of what is now known as the United States. So indigenous law, indigenous knowledge, which really contains the law, the philosophy, and the beliefs of indigenous peoples is a legitimate knowledge base, and that's where I begin. And it's a knowledge base that gives rise to a law that is subject to respect and can also give rise to human rights. Indigenous knowledge is ancient knowledge because it's knowledge that does go back to time immemorial, from the beginning of time in our collective memory. And it is this, the importance of recognizing indigenous knowledge is that it opens a portal to understand and to give legitimacy to Native perspectives, as well as to give an understanding of the indigenous legal tradition. Our law regarding the land, I don't think, is law that is easy for others to grasp, because the idea is that our law is connected to the land. And that is what one of the things that makes our law unique. It is tied to traditional land, ancestors, and acknowledges that the land is alive and linked to our ancestors and was given to us and remains so, even as other legal regimes change this or seek to change this. There is both spirituality and sacredness that is embedded in indigenous knowledge, and a recognition that this knowledge is contained or connected to specific place and therefore occupies specific space. So it is important to recognize and to consider the indigenous legal tradition or traditional law in order to protect our tribal understandings, our lands, and to inform treatment and protection of former lands. To me, this would seem simple, but it is not, and it is complicated because of both cultural and legal imperialism. So this is really where my work begins. The difficulties that arise when indigenous legal tradition and the common law tradition are mixed, and what result that has on law within indigenous communities in the United States, as well as what impacts that has when indigenous law is used external to Indian communities, for example, in the court systems, or as a basis for rights that we would argue arise as a result of our indigenous legal tradition. In the United States, due to federal policies to reorganize indigenous governments in 1934, to resemble organized municipalities based on the adoption of constitutions, which included the incorporation of the American style of justice into tribal systems, which also included the introduction of tribal police to enforce federal regulations, which at that time suppressed indigenous culture, religions, and legal tradition itself. This is sort of where we began to see the mixture of the indigenous legal tradition with the American common law tradition. But yet today, the indigenous legal tradition within tribal communities is alive. It's known as living law. It is law that is not static, as we've heard earlier today, and oftentimes can be referred to as a law of the land. In Australia, this description, the law of the land, is one that I heard often in conference proceedings, recognizing that this law is in fact connected to the land, as I said, because it arises from an ecological order. And this law has roots from time immemorial and has some aspects of it which are known as foundational law, which is immutable, although it is not static because these strands of the law that are immutable continue through today, and the law that governs the people as a matter of their social reality is in fact a flexible law. So it is traditional law which exists in the presence. So I think that just understanding traditional law, understanding that it is grounded or it is a part of a larger knowledge system, and having some understanding of what that knowledge system is and how it operates and how it is similar or dissimilar to Western knowledge is incredibly important when one begins to work with customary law, traditional law, or the indigenous legal tradition. There's a saying that I think fits this quite aptly, that there is no tolerance without respect and no respect without knowledge. And so it's important to have a knowledge of how customary law it sits within a larger framework, and that it is diverse for, you know, in whatever context one is considering customary law. How much time do I have? Okay. I wanted to draw from some work that I'm doing currently on both indigenous identity and repatriation. I don't think I'm going to have a lot of time to do that, but let me at least make a few points. There is law in the United States and in other nations where the indigenous legal tradition exists, which seeks to work with customary law. But I would say that one of the demarcations of U.S. law that attempts to do this is that the indigenous legal tradition is not well understood by the courts. And oftentimes, it is not even recognized as existing. Sometimes this is because of its great diversity, and it is viewed as being too unwieldy as a result of this diversity to recognize and to manage. For example, in the state of New Mexico, we have 23 different tribal communities, and they can be extremely diverse from one another, including the 19 Pueblos, who essentially come from the same group of peoples. But even within the 19 Pueblos in the state of New Mexico, there is and can be a great deal of diversity in terms of how they manage things internally. It is often not understood because it requires a knowledge of language, a knowledge of society, religion, art, and philosophy. And its texts are often unrecognized in the current legal frame in which, for example, in the United States, we are schooled in. Some of those texts include story, including the origin and the journey narratives of peoples. It includes the songs, the ceremonies, symbols, and the stories, as well as the land itself, that the land itself can contain law. All of these things can be difficult to understand for one indigenous community, and when you're talking about several indigenous communities, it can get difficult. So shorthand understandings stand in for complete understandings. And so often when we talk about customary law, it is not, we're not talking about customary law as it is connected to specific indigenous communities. Let's see. I am working with identity and how identity has been, or indigenous identity membership has been defined by federal courts by the federal government and the different policies around that. I have also looked at repatriation and how repatriation has been affected by federal law. But yet it is these two areas, identity or recognition of membership within tribes, repatriation, they have not been connected to indigenous understandings of both their own identity or their connection to and their entitlement to their artifacts and their human remains. And so there's been a lack of understanding that based on indigenous legal traditions, there are understandings about identity, there are understandings about cultural artifacts and human remains that are unclear to the courts who interpret law and create law concerning both. So I think I need to conclude, and I've only just touched on, or just barely touched on, the work that I'm doing in both membership law and repatriation law. But I want to conclude by saying that the indigenous legal tradition, this law is extremely powerful law. It continues to operate. It recognizes our connection to the land and to one another. It is not compartmentalized in the sense that one can go into a community and say, show me the law, or here is a law, and the law is here, in the same way that perhaps we could within our society, within our law in the United States in terms of being able to put our hands on books and statutes in the Constitution and pull them out. But it's a part of our existence, and it's connected to philosophies and belief. Often it's referred to as original instructions about how we are to live in a particular area. Even in this technological age. And it bumps up against many cherished Western notions of law and democracy, including gender and equality, which lays difference aside, representative democracy versus participatory democracy, separation of church and state versus theocracy, and individual freedoms versus group or communal rights and prioritization. Instead, we speak of such things as the law of relationships, the law of responsibilities and obligations, the law of the people, the law of the land, and the law of survival and continuance. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to open the floor for questions, and I'm actually going to start us off here, if I might. Professor Zuni Cruz indicated that additional law, that indigenous law does help to protect traditions of Native cultures within the United States, and I wanted to open the first question talking about from an international development and an international law perspective. The incorporation of customary law is generally thought of as a means to protecting traditions and preserving culture. But one of the things that we've discussed in the panels today is that within many states, customary law has been codified and generalized across states, particularly where there are many different peoples within that state. And so I wanted to get some opinions on how successful the incorporation of customary law is in achieving the goal of protecting traditions and protecting cultures, particularly when it is formalized within a state.
Well,
is that on?
Okay. Yeah. I did mention that at least one country I know, Tanzania, attempted that codification of customary law. Many of the cases I have dealt with arising from this codification indicate a distortion when actual problems do arise and you try to apply the law as written. In one particular case, most strangely, the Chief Justice Nyerali was dealing with a case and confessed that he didn't even know that there had been this particular codification of the tradition of customary law, which was in existence for about 20 years. But so the question is what really happens, and of course in South Africa they've had this experience where the customary law was purportedly put in written form. If you define customary law as an expression, I liked this last, the law as expression of the survival and continuance of a particular community, as Professor Cruz just said, it's a living law. And the moment you reduce it, this is why probably they are right to say they're talking about, instead of customary law, they say common law as applied by the courts. Once the courts begin to apply the rules and they are contained in judgments, then it ceases to really be customary law. It's common law. And if you put it in a statute, it ceases to be part of the customary law. It's part of the statute law. So there is a tension between describing customary law as written in statutory or judicial cases. And therefore, what is the solution? I do not know what the solution is, but I do subscribe, as I said in the end, that we have to get progressive development of this customary law to fit with the passing of time. There are two ways one can do it. You can have like a house of chiefs that is constantly updating the law as it goes, but obviously it is going to be updated in terms of written form and of course getting distorted as to what they think the House of Chiefs is the evolution of society at that particular time. And after about 10 years, it is out of date because then the situation has changed. The other way is to let the courts apply the law as they see today, and that judgment has no precedential value as such, except to the extent that it reflects the court's understanding of what the law is at that particular time, and constantly discovering what the particular law is at a particular situation and could be changing. So what would be the solution? I do not know, but the solution adopted by those who purport to produce a code, they destroy the customary law, because then obviously it's no longer customary law.
Thank you. I think I share the same observation regarding codification, in that the law then can become static, because then who are the experts who will interpret this law? If it's the courts, are the courts knowledgeable of the legal history, the language, the exceptions that could occur as a result of, some facts that might change the law, and it also, I think it's difficult to codify if you're talking about, say, even one state. As I said, in New Mexico, there are 23 different tribes, and so I'm not sure how you would go about codifying the law for diversity of different tribal nations. In the United States, there are over 500 indigenous tribes, and so I think that it gets difficult. But there's also, as I mentioned, a sacredness to the law, and so that in some matters simply would not be disclosed, or the recitation of the law or the law is to be handled in certain ways in certain tribal communities, so that how you even approach the law it, I think, could be problematic. And as I said, one of the aspects of the law is its orality, and which I think is linked to its the fact that it's alive, that it can change, and I guess it's linked to this idea of when you put something down in writing, it can become static.
I suppose I'd question whether many of the efforts to actually codify customary law or to define customary law are really genuine about creating space for customary law. I think that when you immediately say, in most of the constitutions that I've read, customary law is allowed as long as it doesn't go against many of the constitutional principles, most of which are fundamentally about individualism. And the communities that I know the most about in Australia, they're, again, there's a great deal of variety, but the fundamental basis of law is not the individual. I don't can't necessarily explain to you how the social networks or how the relational aspects of those laws work, but there are many rights that are not assigned to everybody, and that people have knowledge and rights in different contexts, and we have Australian law has a very particular view about what equality is, and it is very much same, not different. And I think that doesn't work for most of the communities where I've worked. Having said that, in most of the communities where I work, it is the international processes or international companies that are making the mess, and that communities are trying to hold into account, and they can't do so through traditional structures. They can deal with their own issues through traditional structures, but they can't hold an international company to account through an indigenous structure. So there needs to be some ways that these two different ways of ordering society can speak to each other, because there isn't, they're totally interpenetrated. And so I think there is quite a lot of the tradition now of dealing with hybridity and trying to think about how can, well, we've heard about the Ethiopian constitution where they tried to do, you know, something which some people have criticized as ethnic federalism, but others have said, well, look, actually this is a great compromise in a situation where you have warring factions and they actually do have to come to live together in some kind of, however sort of artificial it may be, created state. And how do you know, these I think there's lots of locally driven solutions in the area where I live, both in the Pacific. There's been many communities who've drawn off constitutional traditions but created their own sort of administrative structures. I think we also heard about Somaliland. So I think there are traditions where, are situations where things have kind of been written and international frameworks and laws have been drawn upon. But to me, it's usually worked when they've been drawn upon by the community itself to actually translate rather than necessarily imposed on the community.
Could I just add one thing? I think in approaching customary law, one has to have a different way of thinking. Because if we think in terms of what we know as law and apply and institutions through which the law is administered, then I think we miss the point. I think the societies that cling to and still abide by customary law are having a different objective. They are dealing with issues as they arise to maintain social equilibrium. They're not purporting to set up, we've had the word immutable norms applicable for all situations at all times. They adjust as the situations arise. I'll tell you one good example. My brother died some time back, and I organized, according to our tribal customs, the last funeral rites for my brother. So I collected several of the elders of our clan to be present. And of course, they have to be able to approve the heir. And they have to deal with a lot of issues during that said, you know, it's a whole day, all night thing. And very early in the morning, the air is pronounced, and there is a celebration, and everybody goes. But during the night, several issues are resolved. In other words, there are a lot of pending and outstanding issues on land, on marriage, on everything that touches the clan are discussed and resolved. One of the issues I raised was we are having a big problem. My brother's eldest or living child is a girl. He remarried and has two boys, one older, one younger, and a girl in between. I said, these days, you know, the rules don't allow us to discriminate against women. So I think we should allow this girl to be my brother's heir. We discussed it, and the elders said, well, that may be so, but not now, maybe later. The idea is that when you translate what we do in English terms, inheritance and succession, it's not the same way that the people are understanding it. When you talk about inheritance and succession, everybody here talks about money. What you're inheriting, your land, inheriting, you know, money, you know, something you put in your pocket. But in our traditions, the person who is selected is actually standing in the place of the one who has died as a symbol. It's a symbol, it's a symbolism. And it's a symbolism that continues, because later on, for example, this happens to be a young man, he's about 14, 15 years old, but when he grows up, it will be upon him to be able to resolve conflicts as they arise in the family, because he's now inheriting the eldest son in my father's family. So you can, when the daughter, actually as it turns out, gets married, she leaves our clan. She's no longer part of the clan. And she, in fact, one of the complaints that were dealt with during that meeting, night meeting, was by some part of the family where the daughters came, but their children didn't come, were not invited. In my own family, they were saying, but how come in your family the daughters have come with their children? I said, I think it's a healthy thing. But it's because those children are not considered to be part of the clan, and therefore they don't belong in the clan festivities. So you have a big problem to be able to resolve the issue. When it goes into parliament, it goes into national instruments, the women we're talking about it, they're talking about property, because the person who becomes the heir takes on the house, takes on the land, it becomes a big issue. But I try to tell my students that there is two things that take place. One is relates to replacement of the person that has left as a symbol for the family and for the clan. Then if you want to work out a legal solution to some of these problems, then craft out a different system for the distribution of the property. Then you can say the property will be distributed equally to all the children. It's fine. There's nothing in customary law that says all the property goes to the heir. However, the homestead, which happens to have been his homestead, the place where everybody can always come back and consider it home, will have to be under the custody of the heir, because in trust, because when everybody has lost a home, that's where they can come back. So these things are a little bit complex, because the customs are not there to resolve on a long-term basis forever a rule. It is an issue has arisen, the elders do meet, and they find a solution that deals with that particular situation. And if we want to be recording, you can record it, this is what they did today. And later on it can be looked upon, and they might say, well, that may have been okay for that family, for that time, but now I think this situation, times have changed, I think we'll do it differently. That's very difficult to put into the kind of conception of law and legal systems that we ourselves are accustomed to.
Thank you. Do you have any questions from the audience? Thank you.
Hi. I'd like to hear from any of today's speakers about your observations of the role civil society has played in facilitating some of this dialogue from formal decision makers, constitutional processes, with indigenous leaders and trying to bridge that gap where there's an understanding and relevance of human rights, whether it's universal norms or protecting the rights at the community level. What have you seen? What's succeeded? What's failed?
I think the liberal state, the liberal state and liberalism that is being driven by the human rights project, of course, conflicts with the traditional system, because the traditional system is constructed on the basis of the preservation of the group, the family, and this is, you know, of the family, of the clan, of the society. So individual rights, as written by the Human Rights Covenant, exist only to the larger areas, thou shalt not kill, although the state takes the opportunity to kill every time it feels like. The thing is that the idea, this is why I have a problem with justice, where you think that you're administering justice and then you go and kill the people who killed others. So the thing is that the rules or the norms that are constructed are all aimed at the preservation of this social fabric, largely because, and they were arrived at to remedy the situation, because if you killed my brother, the reaction was my family came up and killed someone in your family. So then comes the reconciliation. What do we do to try to make sure that you go forward without having another member of the tribe being killed? And the social contract that is concerned here is not dealing with individual rights. Now, to the extent as you talk about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I think a lot of people can sign on to that. I think you'll find that many of the societies, including even traditional societies, can sign on to the core. I've used this word before in a human rights discussion, and I was castigated, because they're supposed to be indivisible and whatever it is. But the core rights, as contained in the Universal Declaration of Rights, I think can be accepted as universal. But when you tack on all these additional appendages that have grown up, then you find a lot of divergence. And therefore, when you talk about human rights and individual rights, you have to be careful exactly what you are defining. I mean, for example, I talked about the right to privacy that has been accorded in this country to the control of a woman's right to have an abortion. I mean, that is something on which there will be differences in different societies. I mean, the question of saying that somebody who is engaged in homosexual activities has rights as against the community's its own sense of whether this is right or wrong, that again you are going to find a lot of differences. So we have to accept that societies have different perceptions of what is right and wrong. This is where I think the Human Rights Project has failed, to believe that we can create a universal ethical system that is acceptable worldwide and applicable everywhere is impossible. And you have to respect each individual society's perception of what is right and wrong. That's what I think.
Would either of the other panelists like to respond to the initial question on the role of civil society?
Well, let me just say that I guess I view the indigenous legal tradition as creating or giving rise itself to human rights, which I guess then can be described as human rights from arising out of that indigenous legal tradition, so that they have maybe a basis and a and some divergence perhaps from human rights as they would be crafted at the international level. And so I think that that's not unrelated to what my colleague has said, that I think that human rights also need to respect the framing that societies would give to those human rights. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Megan, then we'll do one more question, and then we're hitting up against our time here. So let's just do these two last questions, and then we'll wrap up.
I have a couple questions and comments. First, I think there's sort of a connection between the issues that we're coming up against in this panel and some of the issues that were addressed in the first panel about the role of sort of this idea of individual human rights and collective rights and the state building process, or the need to formalize systems internationally and make sense of things that maybe we don't understand so well. And I think the Banjul Charter that was mentioned earlier is interesting in that it incorporates both individual human rights and collective rights and puts them on equal footing and doesn't establish a priority between the two. And I wonder if any of the panelists could address that document and where that fits into this conversation, the idea that you can have collective rights to self-determination and so on and individual rights somehow interacting on equal footing with one another. And I guess my second question was to Professor Cruz specifically. I wonder whether you could address the way that individuals within the Pueblo community, as you're able to, as you've seen them interact with a sense of, if there is a sense of belonging to more than one community, a sense of belonging to the Pueblo community and a sense of perhaps belonging to a larger community in the United States, and to the extent that they interact with more than one legal system, both a tribal legal system and a federal legal system, how you see people making choices around that sort of dual citizenship, if you want to call it that. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and get in our second questioner now, and then we can answer.
Hi, again, I too have two questions. I apologize. The first is also directed towards Professor Cruz. I'm just interested in your perspective as a judge to understand what you have identified as the challenges in the application of indigenous legal traditions, maybe some examples of the areas in which you've found the most challenge. And the second question, I think, comes from something that Ms. Sage spoke of, in that when you have this externally imposed, let's say, development project that creates conflict within indigenous communities, what then should be the set of norms that govern resolution of that dispute? And that is open to anybody, because we're seeing more and more of that, certainly, and I'd like to know about that.
Thank you.
Let me see if I can remember the two questions and try to answer them with one answer. I think that we do see the use of external systems and internal systems by tribal people for various reasons, or perhaps to play one off against the other, because you can do different things in the systems. And I think that as long as you have indigenous communities within a wider or larger nation that that will happen. The tribal systems in the United States, of course, are free to apply their own tribal law, which can be the same as or different from outside court systems. And so that, you know, I think that is something that we see occur. In terms of specific examples of some of the difficult things that can arise within tribal court systems, I think that one of them is simply trying to place on your court individuals who are able to understand the customary law, as well as individuals who can understand law as it is framed within the common law system. And then one of the challenges that arises is for those two people, or those two types of people, to be able to work together to craft solutions. And I'm speaking out of my experience as a justice on our Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals hears the appeals from the tribal court. We're the court of last resort within our structure, and we and five individuals sit on the court currently. There are three lawyers and two individuals who sit as people who represent the traditional community. And when we began, we had the court is 10 years old. It feels extremely young. I mean, it feels like we started yesterday. But we had some issues arise concerning language and the fluency of a language, the need to know Tiwa in order to sit on the body. We had issues arise concerning whether we even needed rules. You know, were rules necessary? And then when we resolved that issue, then we had to work between the two understandings of us as lawyers and our elders as more traditional people who understood the process of resolving disputes in a different way. And so we had to sort of bridge that gap and gain a trust between the two of us to even produce rules. But I think that we continue to see challenges in terms of how we handle issues. You know, as somebody said earlier, it's so much easier to go and pull those New Mexico statutes off of the shelves and open them up and say, well, this is the way that they do it, so we should do it that way as well, versus, you know, considering what is our law? What is our law of marriage? What is our law? What is our law of relationships? You know, what do we know of how this has been resolved in the past, and is this the correct way to do things based on a number of things, a person's, you know, relationship within the community. And I think that there are a number of challenges. I think that if you have a court system that doesn't have individuals on that court system who understand the language and understand the history and the traditions and this sort of thing, you have a very different pronouncement of what the law is than when you do. And I say that simply because I've seen it, in that oftentimes the lawyers on the court would be far down the path of this is the way you resolve it in a more Western style or way of thinking about an issue, and our elder or the individuals who represent the community, the more traditional way of thinking, you know, it's almost like we could feel them grabbing us and pulling us back and saying, okay, wait, okay, let's think about this way before, you know, you resolve the issue going off one path. And so sort of the joining of the two, who you have on the court, who is thinking through issues, can be difficult when you have two different types of people, but can I think produce a different type of approach to law than when you have only Western-trained individuals who speak English only or exclusively versus those who are bilingual or who are able to understand both languages?
The Banjul Charter, that's the African Charter of Rights, was framed at a time, I think you may recall, when the OAU, of Organization of African Union, was organized to fight for the independence of South Africa and as one of its main objectives, I mean, to try to get rid of apartheid in South Africa and Namibia, and I don't think even Zimbabwe was independent at the time. And the irony of all this, what's going on today, is that the Africans, for the longest time, were using the international covenants, the human rights, as their weapon to fight against colonialism. We used to very great effect the human rights instruments to fight against the brutality and of the colonial enterprise, because I don't know whether you are aware of what was going on in the colonies, but there was nothing called human rights during the colonial period, despite what they're telling us today. I mean, you had detention without trial. I mean, you didn't really have rights at all if you were an African. And the Africans used the human rights covenants and, you know, as a means to achieve independence. And the charter was drafted in a way as a reflection or recording of the differences in the understanding of the extent of human rights. I mean, we were arguing that self-determination is as much of a human rights as other rights, which was denied. And therefore, you will find in the Banjul Charter room set aside for self-determination. The right to development was also incorporated as a right. Whereas if you are dealing with individual rights, these two would not be recorded as rights. The rights for the independence movement, you know, the groups that were fighting for independence were also incorporated as having rights. Now, in addition to that, you will find some specific mention of issues, for example, the duties. While you are so concerned about rights, in our human rights or whatever perception, these rights are counteracted by other duties that you owe to society, one, which is also recorded, that you have a duty to preserve the stability of the state, and you also have duties to your parents, you know. Children have duties to take care of their parents in old age. And therefore, we conceive of rights and duties, rights and corresponding duties, which is missing in the human rights covenant. So the charter was conceived as a counteract, a regional charter, to respond to the over-concentration of individual rights as written in the various human rights covenants. There was no intention to provide a solution to the tension that may exist between either the duties or the group rights and the individual rights. And I don't think that any of the covenants either do reconcile, attempt to reconcile Because while you talk about the right of speech, free speech, you also find that there is criminalization of slander and defamation. So the antinomy of rights or values, I think that's the word that's used, the antinomy of values will exist unresolved in either system, whether it be in the individual rights only document or in the document that also recognizes group rights. So this antinomy of values remains unresolved, and the courts have to weigh according to the situation whether the exercise of a right here that seems to invade into the rights of another, which in any particular situation should give way to the other. It's almost like recently rights have been given to corporations which might violate the individual rights to be able to elect your own representatives.
Thank you. Ms. Sage, would you like the last word?
I was just going to address the question of which norms should prevail with, I presume you're talking about natural resource developments, I suppose we call them. And I suppose, again, to me here, there's a theory and then there's a practice. And I'm a bit, at this stage in my life, I'm a pragmatist as opposed to where I probably was a few years ago. And I kind of think whatever you can bring to the table, the communities where we work, there is massive internal conflict caused by international corporations. Interestingly, I think kind of for the discussions today, in most of the countries where I'm currently working, there was a handover of state of land to custom right at the time when international corporations were kind of accessing land in ways that possibly it would have been nice to have a state hold them into account. And it's a kind of interesting moment in terms of a recognition of custom that actually then communities aren't able to enforce. But there is also, I think, things at that level, one of the major sort of causes of a lot of the internal conflicts is the translation between customary usage, what one might call usage or access rights, and formal legal recognition of those rights that end up in things like benefit sharing agreements often actually really distort local customary systems. So I think if you can at the local level work for internal equity and try and work out what types of translating legal identities are the most appropriate for those communities, that's something that we spend a lot of time doing in the work that I'm doing, where we look at a whole range of different formal or modern legal frameworks that might be more appropriate for those communities in their benefit sharing agreements. Is a customary trust better? Is a company better for that type of framework? What types of benefit? How do you ensure benefit sharing rights are actually enshrined somehow? Is there a way to actually recognise group ownership in a way that doesn't always have one person speaking? Or can you actually contextualise when people can speak? So that sort of internal equity, but then as far as I'm concerned, a lot of the responsibility exists at the international level. And I don't know, I mean, things like the RUGI process or processes that actually allow more powerful players to hold international corporations to account. So to me, it's at every level. You just bring whatever you can to the table because it's a mess.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We're going to conclude with that. Thank you very much, Professor Sikandi, Ms. Sage, and Professor Cruz. And I'm going to turn the table over to Eleanor Thompson for closing remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much again to all our panelists. We really appreciate the discussion and the insights and the frank discussion, I should say, from each of you. And thank you very much, Megan Stewart, for being our moderator. So after this entire day, what can we take from what we've heard today? We've heard about the manipulation and politicization of customary law, the attempt to reform customary law through domestic legislative processes as well as international human rights advocacy, the problem of crafting group rights through the lens or conduit of individual rights. We've heard about misconceptions that are held in quote-unquote developing justice systems and the need for the law to be responsive to the land and or the survival of the community. I think one thing that we can certainly take out from this conference is that in looking at customary law, there's a need for us to think of the law as dynamic. And therefore, it can't be imposed or resolved or universalized. So have we resolved anything? No, probably not. But at least we have different perspectives at this point on, I think we have a better sense of what customary law is. I think we have different perspectives on the approaches that different disciplines take or have taken to customary law. And I think that we can also resolve that this issue cannot be resolved, and certainly not from a top-down cookie-cutter approach. In terms of what this means for us as human rights lawyers, I think we should use the case studies that have been discussed today to learn lessons and take from it mainly which approaches do not work, but really learn lessons from the case studies as opposed to generalizing them to say that this is why we can't take this approach in all situations. I think the case studies really, we have to look at the facts of each case study and the circumstances in which the community operates, et cetera. So again, I thank everyone who has participated in helping us to talk about, but maybe not completely resolve this issue. But I look forward to further discussion from all of the different disciplines as we move forward. Finally, I would like to just thank all of our speakers. Again, Professor Eisenstadt, who started us off this morning, thank you very much. And now that you are back, if anyone has any further questions for you, I believe that they can take advantage of that during the reception as we mingle outside, or any of our other panelists. We greatly appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to come and be with us. Some of you have flown from very far, some not from not so far, but you've all taken out time, and we appreciate it. I'd also like to thank our working group who kind of helped to spearhead this project, Ann Parsons, Soumya Venkatesh, Brian Evans, Kavita Kapoor, and I'm probably missing someone. Alvir. I'd also like to thank Professor Mitali Jain and the International Human Rights Law Clinic, Professor Jain and Hadar Harris. Actually, we probably should be given the most credit for getting this kind of rolling in terms of the idea. And so we thank you for at least bringing it to or wanting to bring this issue to light in this community. I'd also like to thank, again, Hadar Harris and Maria Lakshin at the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law. A very big thanks to Megan Chapman, who put in a great deal of work on helping to organize this conference, along with Jennifer Goldsmith of the Human Rights Brief, and many staff of the Human Rights Brief, who helped to put together the packets that you have and prepare us for this conference. And of course, we have to just thank Jennifer Dabson, Denise Hussey Richards, and the rest of the special events and continuing legal education staff for all of the little logistics that you probably don't see, but that helped to make this a success. So thanks to everyone, and we look there will be a reception now just in the hallway. We look forward to continuing to talk informally about these issues.